Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 26, 2002. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon, our presenter is Vitor Westelli. Today's session number is WEV 2002-03, and it is titled The Church as Community of Solidarity and Protest, Session 3, Church and Society. Let's listen in.
Okay, let's get this tape rolling. And once more, has anyone been not been in any of the other two sessions?
I haven't been.
Okay, my name is Vitor Westelli, and I'm a Brazilian. And I have been working in the United States for the last 8 or 9 years in Chicago at the Lutheran School of Theology. So what I need to do today is just to close up with a story. What I was discussing last time on the church and the cross, so that I would like to do that in order to make the transition for the discussion that was scheduled for today on church and on church and society. Where I was last time was on the description of the way in which Luther lays out the what he calls the seven marks of the church, which is basically a rephrasing of the two fundamental signs that marks the unity of the church in the Augsburg Confession, which is the preaching of the word and the celebration of the sacraments. And then Luther adds very strangely the cross as one of the fundamental marks, cross and suffering. For him, the two are the cross is a sort of a metonym for suffering. And I was just discussing with you what that means, and I would like to illustrate the presence of this cross in the midst of ecclesiological discussions in order to try to bring some images to what I was trying to present. And the way in which I was describing the church and its relationship to the cross is one in which I was emphasizing that the church is always this community that is experiencing the presence of God in the midst of a reality of absence. I have used those two Greek words that come very much together and come very close together when discussing the question of the cross. The words are akousia and parousia. This word here, parousia, is often translated as second coming, which doesn't have anything to do with second coming whatsoever. The word simply means presence. Where Jesus makes his presence, that is parousia. And so second coming only in the sense that Jesus is always coming again, right? And apousia is its opposite, its absence. Its absence. So the experience, for example, of the cross, the disciples, in face of what was happening in the cross, were under this this overwhelming sense of apousia, overwhelming sense of absence. God was there, dead. On that cross, and that was the interpretation that was given, and that's the way in which they were trying to cope with that experience, and that was not an easy experience. And if you go to the early text of the New Testament, like for example 1 Corinthians, Paul doesn't have a language to speak about that. He speaks in paradoxical terms: weakness, strength, foolishness, wisdom. And so he can only use these contradictory terms and without making any systematic sense of it, because the experience is so overwhelming. If you go to the Gospel of Mark, which is almost at the same time, a bit later, in the year 60s of the first century, what you are going to see there is this basic sense of bewilderment in face of that which they were experiencing. And this bewilderment was expressed very well in the words of Jesus in the cross: my God, why have you forsaken me?" Right? And this is the last word. And it's very interesting that that the gospel also counts, and that's really interesting, because this, among very few other passages in the New Testament, in addition to Jesus calling Father Abba, in addition to speaking to that girl that he raises up, Talita Kumi, right? Girl, raise up. There are very few passages in which the actual words in Aramaic of Jesus are being quoted. And there is very intentionally, the author of Mark says, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," my God, why have you forsaken me? And there, the word Abba is not there. It's my God, it's this distant God that has forsaken it. And there is no mistake about the fact that they knew what that meant. It was forsakenness, was absence, was God abandoning the world to its own design, but at the same time, God dying on that cross. So that was part of what the experience of the first disciples was about. And in the midst of this experience, they had to make some sense of that. Incidentally, there are some people that say, "Well, he's called when he says Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." Some people misunderstand it and read it or hear it as he was calling for Elijah to deliver him, right? Oh, he's calling for Elijah. And Mark says that exactly in order to convey to the readers, we knew what he was saying. There is no mistake on it. Even if people had wishing hearing to hear something that was not there, that was not what was meant. What was meant is God has really forsaken them. So in face of that forsakenness, in face of the fact of this bewilderment in the experience of the cross, I think we are going to find the shaping of what makes up for the basic configuration of what I would regard to be the profile, the early profile that the church takes. There are different ways in which you are going to justify biblically the foundation of the church. As I mentioned to you, Luther goes to the Shabbat in the beginning of the institution of the Shabbat in the beginning of Genesis and says that is where the church is founded. The Roman Catholic Church goes to, I think, chapter 16 of Matthew on the power of the keys, when on this rock I build my church. The words that Jesus addresses to Peter, right? So they say that is the moment in which the church is prefigured. The Protestant tradition has normally gone to the Pentecostal account, the story of Acts 2, and says, well, that's the moment in which when the miracle of listening, right? Because it's much more than the miracle of speaking in tongues. It's much more the miracle of listening. Mm-hmm. We can hear them speak in our tongues. So this miracle of listening is really what builds the church. And it's not that I think that's wrong, but I think we are missing one of the fundamental elements that makes up for what the church is in face of the experience of the cross. And that is the story of those women that were there at the foot of the cross. We are going to find in the four Gospels a very interesting divergent accounts of who was there among Jesus' acquaintances, who was there to experience the crucifixion, who could stand that sight, right? And in all of them, there is only one common feature. The women that followed him and provided for him from Galilee, since he left Galilee until he got to Jerusalem. So you're going to have... In Matthew, it just says many women were there, those who were following from Galilee. In Mark, we are going to find some women were there. In Luke, it says that the women were there and all the acquaintances, very vague. In John, we are going to see that there are the women there and then the beloved disciple. Right? So there are different accounts. Who else was there? Whether at all there was somebody else there. But the fundamental feature is that there were women there, and the women that have followed Jesus from Galilee on, so the disciples of Jesus. So what happens is that he is crucified, and there is this story about Joseph from, how do you pronounce that, Arimathea, or is that correct? Yeah. So he takes the body, goes to Pilate, and says, "Can I take the body?" and lays it in a tomb that has never been used before. And then the story says this: all the gospels agree. The women were after, and they checked. It's really interesting. They were the only ones who were there, and they went to check whether the body was really properly laid on that tomb. And the tomb was closed, as it was the custom at that time, in the entrance sort of a cave in on the earth. And so a stone was blocking the entrance, and that would be Jesus's resting place.
Sir, in the yes. face of that, the presence of the women, how could it be that within a century or two, the women were really shunned out in terms of any position of authority or anything else? It got to be in this big masculine church. Did they just overlook that? Did you hear now?
That's a very interesting story, as a matter of fact. And I don't think that happened that fast. And I think it is going to happen that the women are moved out quite late, close to the Constantinian period. And there is one story that is very revealing. It's very revealing. It's in Eusebius. Eusebius, in the 4th century, he was the sort of a 4th to 5th century. He was a sort of the official recorder of the... he was the first church historian after Luke wrote the Acts. But he was the first church historian of the Constantinian church. So, and his idea was to give a sense that the church was always one and with one only sense of mission from the beginning on. That was Eusebius' vision. He was a very conservative theologian. But he has an account of that when he discusses the precepts that Paul has against women speaking in the church. You know that the women should remain silent in the church, right? So he does a very interesting, he reveals a very interesting information of that, in which he does what many people nowadays do, in which they go and they try to understand what is the context in which someone will have to say that. The context is one that people would have to say, listen, women are really speaking too much, isn't it? Because if they would not be speaking, they would not have to be reprehended in order not to speak. And Eusebius has this fantastic story in which, out of his conservatism, he says, the problem is that at that time, Paul was very much concerned that there were the office of the teachers that were normally held by women. And they would instruct the congregation on the teachings of the church. And then there was the office of preaching, which was held by the apostles, right? And no one cared really to listen to them, says Eusebius. So he said, so they had to shut up the women when they were teaching there, because otherwise no one would listen to the apostles. And so that was the way in which they found out. And this is Eusebius, the official, the court theologian of the Constantinian church.
Well, do you give credibility to that story you just told us?
Well, yes, I do. Yes, I do credibility to that. Because I think whether Eusebius had it exactly right or not, well, I do think that something was happening that whatever the women were doing was disturbing the life of the apostles. And this is the point for telling this story that I want to tell. Because what I'm telling this story is about a period that no one really talks much about. What happens between this empty period between a Good Friday and Easter Sunday. It's an empty period. There is no apostle speaking during that time, at least not that we have in the records. Right? There is no apostolic preaching or speaking at that time. And so it is an empty period in the time. It's a period of silence in the time of in this span of time between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. But even if it is not a time of speaking, there is a lot of things and interesting, very interesting things happening during that that period. And the first one is the one that I have already indicated. The Gospel says, well, let's read that. Let's read Mark. Someone, please, read it to me. Mark 15, verse 40 to 16, verse 8. 15:40 to 68. Okay? Please.
There were also women looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and the less, and of Joseph, and Salome, who also followed him and ministered to him when he was in Galilee, and many other women who came up with him to Jerusalem. Now when the evening had come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, coming and taking courage, went into Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate marveled that he was already dead. And summoning the centurion, he asked him if he had been dead for some time. And when he found out from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. Then he bought fine linen, took him down, and wrapped him in the linen. And he laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock, and rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid. Now when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices that they might come and anoint him. Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen, and they said among themselves, "Who will roll away the stone away from the door of the tomb for us?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, for it was very large. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a long white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go and tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him, as he said to you." And they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
Thank you. This story is really fantastic. First of all, I used to say the Christian church, the Christian faith, and the Christian church by in consequence, would probably not be able to affirm the resurrection of the body or the empty tomb if it weren't for those women. Right? No one would have been there to see that it was really empty. So the maximum that we could affirm is apparitions of Jesus, right? Like Paul had an apparition of Jesus. But the radical affirmation that there is a resurrection of the body, there is something that really does not make sense, because apparitions you can have visions and all the rest. But to say that there is a body that has been raised from the dead, 3 days after, actually 2 days, but counting in the Jewish calendar would be 3 days, this would be unusual. This would be something that it's out of this world. And we would not know if there would be anything but an apparition of Jesus if there were not for those women that, first of all, went there to check whether the body really was there. And secondly, were there on the Monday morning to experience or to witness the fact that that the tomb was empty, and that there was this witness there sitting, this angel, whatever you want to call it. He is not here. He has already resurrected. And then it says that he appeared for the first time then to Mary Magdalene. And the first time was not to one of the apostles, and only after that to Peter, but first to Mary Magdalene. So the Christian faith in one way depends really on his rides on the back of a story that is not that noble at all, as most of the Christian stories or the biblical stories for that matter. It's a former prostitute that really is the first witness to whatever belongs to the center of the Christian faith, is the resurrection. But let's see some other aspects of this story. What makes this, for me, the prefiguration of the church, this group of women that go from, that are the eyewitness of that one who they beloved so much, dying in all that pain, they follow that body in a sort of, I call this a labor of mourning and a labor of love, right? So you go there. And the interesting thing is that that happens on Friday. And you know that that according to the Jewish day, the day starts in the evening of the previous night, right? And so by the evening, Jesus dies at noon, and until everything is taken care of and the body is laid there, you can imagine that it should be already time in which the sun was at dusk. What Mark tells us is that those women then, they go home. And the most interesting thing, after having experienced this apousia, this absence of God in the midst, this forsakenness of God, there is an act of pure confidence and reverence, because when the world was falling apart, everything that they believed in was crumbling and was no longer there. They keep the Shabbat. So they observe the Shabbat. Memory is important. Whatever has happened to them had to be preserved. Whatever the history of her people, of their people, was, had to be preserved. As awful as this God at that moment seemed to them, there was still time, or still need for this respect that was due to them, even if it was totally incomprehensible. Totally incomprehensible. So they do that in a total irrational act, because otherwise people would just revolt and say, I don't care about this God anymore. Because this God has forsaken the one who was his son or her son. And so they do that. They do out of respect. But then comes this other. Luke places this before the Shabbat, and Mark places this after the Shabbat. That doesn't matter. But Mark says, when the Shabbat is over, when the Shabbat is over, technically in the evening of Saturday, they go out shopping, right? What do they go shopping for?
Spices
and oils. In order to do what? To prepare
the body.
Yeah, to prepare a balm in order to anoint that dead body. A mad economy, isn't it? Why do you do that? The body is dead in any case. In any case, is dead. It's a mad economy. They know that not even a word of thank are they going to get out of Jesus. This is what I call this labor of love, in which you give yourself to something out of pure love, without ever having the minimal expectation. The minimal expectation of being even recognized for the act, for the gesture that you have given. So they go out, they buy spices, they spend their money, their little money, in something that they are never going, not even get a thank you for that, because that was a body in putrid sense, was a rotting body that they could not help with all the spices that they were buying. But in any case, they wanted to have this last gesture of love by anointing that body rotting in that cave. And so there they go on Sunday morning, early hours in the morning, wondering how would they remove that huge stone that had been rolled against the cave. To their surprise, they got there and the stone is already removed. And they got scared. They got scared because they think that something might have happened, and they might have stolen the body of Jesus, and their act of love to that dead body could not be fulfilled. And then they got into the cave, they got into this hole in this rock where the body was laid, and there was this 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 angel or this person in bright clothes, and say he is no longer here. He is resurrected. So that's where the story about the resurrection of the body starts. There is an empty tomb, and there were people that were there to see the empty tomb, and it was not the apostles. Was not apostle. Were this group of women that went there. So this persistence, dedication to this labor of mourning and love is what characterizes this forming moment of the church. I think it's correct to assume that if it weren't for that. We would have a Christianity that would have a very different shape in the midst of the world today. But then there is this surprise, and this is also part of what the church is. Those women, they were used, or they got used, to manage suffering and to manage tragedies, to manage mourning. And they knew how to do that. They had suffered enough, and they had seen under the domination of the Roman Empire so many people being done injustice to, so many suffering, so many dead, so many being martyred. So they knew how to, in a sense, they knew how to work on that economy of victimization that was there. And so they also thought that they were able to behave in a similar way by encountering the fact that the beloved one, the infinitely beloved one, was dead and was rotten. And they would do what they were able to do, what they were capable of doing. Going there and bringing this oil and the spices to anoint the body. And then the body is not there. And what does the Bible says that overcome them? What does the text that we read?
Fear.
More than that, the word is stronger.
Terror.
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 Terror. How do you think that one would be feeling terror in face of something that magnificent, that someone that they beloved so much finally had resurrected? Right? Why is that? Well, I think the church reacts many times in this way. Those women, they were on control, right? So the church sometimes is very much on control in managing grief, right? And when, even for the sake of having deliverance happening, and then suddenly you don't have any longer this control, you get terrified. Because things are out of control. That is the point that leads them to this terror. Because they don't know how to handle something that was not part of the plan. God cannot do that. In the moment in which God allowed the beloved one to be killed, don't rock our world once more by bringing this person up, and we don't know how to handle that. Because this is unheard of. So we don't know how to handle that, and so I think sometimes the church, that's so good at grief management, reacts very much in the same way when there is this possibility of saying, "Well, there is a new reality and a new possibility. Sorry, we don't need your ointment anymore, because the body is alive and is well." So I find that rather interesting how we interpret that. And I think the terror has to do with the fact that it's not just a resuscitation that's taken place, that they can find the body like in the case of Lazarus, and everything is going to be like it was before the death of the person. No, the point is that the resurrection brings about a new reality that people really don't know how to handle, that people really don't know how to cope with it, how to negotiate in this new way of experiencing what the world is about. And this is the point, because the resurrection always happens outside of the frame in which we see reality. And the frame in which we see reality is always a limited one. There are things that happen outside that we cannot simultaneously see at the same time, right? There was this exposition that I went to see by a French filmmaker, by an English filmmaker, in the streets of Geneva, and he had was an exposition, but it was a very strange exposition because he had these boots all over downtown in the old Geneva, and these boots were made out of you enter this booth and there were two walls with holes on it, so that you would look through those holes, and you could not see the rest of the panorama, the rest of the city. It would focus only on a detail of a doorknob, or a detail of a stair, or something like that. Just a small detail that you have been going and walking by many times, and you never noticed. And then suddenly, by excluding the rest of reality, you would look at that and say, "Oh my goodness, this is really beautiful." And I have been passing here, and I never noticed that because it blended into the general scenery. And so I think this was this director's way of saying, this is the way in which we see reality. It's not only by what we portray of it, but by the cuttings that we make. So in any photographer would know that, right? It's the cutting that is essential to what the picture is depicting. So I think that's the way in which we also see reality. The beauty of what we see depends very much on what we exclude from our field of vision, right? And we always have to exclude something. We don't have the eyes of God. And this is what happens with the resurrection also. It's something that happens outside of this field of vision that we have, but we have only indications of it in the midst of our frame that we have chosen. Take for example a text. A page of a written text in which there is some information that really will change the whole meaning by which you are going to interpret this text. And this information is given through a cipher, a footnote, an asterisk, or something like that, that points to you here to some information that puts this all into context, but it's outside of this page. Let's say it's on the back of the book, right? So take this as an analogy. What we have in front of us is the page, and suddenly there is this asterisk and says, this information is really true. The documentation for it is there, but we don't have access because we cannot turn the page. We cannot yet turn the last page and look at what this information is about. So I think I use this as a sort of an analogy for us to imagine what this talk about the resurrection is about. It's a sort of a cipher within the limited scope that we have that says, yes, eventually, you are going to see that this is really the case. But now, trust that cipher. Trust that footnote, trust that asterisk or whatever is there in the text, that is going to be finally corroborated by what you are going to see. So another example that one could give about the resurrection, about this which falls outside of our field of vision, is one that I have often used. 50 years ago, okay, use that as an analogy. 50 years ago, if you would ask anyone trained in the West, in the medical sciences, if you would ask anyone about the therapeutic merits of acupuncture, what would you get?
Nonsense.
Laughter, right? Nonsense. It so happens that in the last 20 or 25 years, neurologists in the West have established that there is indeed a connection with the ending of our nervous system in the surface of our skins with the brain, which being activated can provoke a number of different reactions, killing pain, and also having therapeutic, don't ask me, I'm not a doctor in medicine, and that it can have therapeutic. So it is established. It's not a panacea. It's not going to cure everything. But it is recognized by the Western patterns themselves that there are some therapeutic merits in acupuncture. So, you see, 50 years ago, we had one frame of reference in which anything that fell outside of it would be ridiculous, would be unbelievable. Okay, 25 years later, or 30 years later, what you're going to see is that this frame in by which we see reality, it shifted a little bit, and now you are seeing that which was outside of your field of vision and say, oh, it does fit inside of the panorama here. I just couldn't see it before, right? So this is the example that I wanna give. What the women expect for what experience of the resurrection is, it falls outside of a given frame that we have, that we cannot access yet, So the talk about the resurrection is really upsetting because we either have to regard it as senseless or ridiculous, or then we really get nervous about it because it belongs to a realm that we cannot control, that's outside of our manipulation. It's outside of our of the capability that we have of having it under control, tamed, and say, well, you're going to behave in the way in which I expect you to behave. And that is really not an experience that we humans are very comfortable with, right? We like to be in control. We like to know exactly where things fit. So this was also the experience of those women. And that's the reason why I say that those women and this movement, this almost a dance that goes from Friday and the women going to the tomb and then going back, observing the Shabbat in the midst of all that absence, in the midst of all that craziness, in the midst of all that abandonment, and then going into buying spices and oil in order to prepare a balm to anoint a dead, putrescent body, only to find with terror that things have gotten out of their control, even out of the control of the economy of their own mourning, that they were pretty much in control. So that is what the experience is. And I think this is part of the experience of the church, part of the ambiguous experience of the church. That the church is that space that accompanies people in the midst of this experience of becoming a victim, of suffering injustice, in order to be there without much expectation, without much certainty. Yes, expectation, yes, hope. But the hope against hope, that you don't see any, this is what Paul says that Abraham had, right? A hope against all hope. That means a hope when any hope was simply nil, zilt, annihilated. So there was some hope there. This is the reason the Brazilian former bishop, Don Elder Câmara, he used to call the church and the communities the Abrahamic minorities, said, well, really the church is there where this hope against hope, as Paul described the faith of Abraham, where this hope against all hope is really present. And I think this is what characterizes very much, it's at the very core of the act of those women. There was some hidden hope there in a totally hopeless situation. In a totally hopeless situation. And certainly not even a hope that could be named. But there was implicitly this kind of hope in that which I have called the labor of mourning and of love. There is a poem by Wendell Berry that I like very much because he captures, you know Wendell Berry? He's collected poems. I just saw it. They are in the bookstore. And this poem is "The Way of Pain" is called. It's in that collection as well. And he says the following. That is the last verse of the poem. I read of Christ crucified, the only one born, sacrificed to flesh and time and all our woe. He died and rose. But who does not tremble for his pain, his loneliness, and the darkness of the sixth hour? Unless we cry like Mary at his tomb, giving him as lost, Easter morning will not come. Unless we cry like Mary, giving him as lost, Easter morning will not come. And I thought this is really, really important, because we tend to collapse. We just jump from Good Friday to Easter Monday, and we don't realize that in this span of time, there is something so essential that really serves as the paradigm, serves as the model through which and by which the church has found its first profile, its first way of being in the midst of a world that is always so unpredictable and so painful in terms of its experience. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Was it not the customary? I mean, the women went because it was the social custom for the women to anoint the bodies.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, it is, and it's
still
today.
There's never been a man to do that.
Yes, and it's always been the case that in many societies. But the fact that it is a cultural custom for people to do, the very way in which, for whatever reason it happens, that the women are assigned. Or assign themselves this task. This is a task that implies this. Whether it's socially imposed or chosen, it is nevertheless the same act of love and mourning that's taken place. But you're right. It's many different societies. Not only at that time until today, we are going to find women performing precisely this function. Yes. Okay, church and society. When talking about church and society, we normally end up in some discussion about entities, which is an essentialist approach to the relationship between church and society. So we presume that we know what the church is in the first place, and then we presume what society is in the second place. And now it's the only question that we have is to establish some relationship of parity or correspondence between these two entities, church and society. What I'm trying to do is to, again, think outside of the box, think outside of the way in which we normally have tried to frame the question of church and society, and think of the church in a different way, in a more dynamic way. The church as an emerging reality in the midst of the social relationships in which we are engaged. The traditional ways, for example, are the ones that have been made very popular by the greatest sociologist of the 20th century, or the most quoted sociologist of the 20th century, Max Weber, and his friend, the theologian Erich Strauch, in which he talks about this relationship between church and society in this essentialist term, that there is a church and there is society, and then he's trying to establish correlations of how they relate to each other. Or then the famous North American theologian and sociologist of religion as well, H. Richard Niebuhr, in Christ and Culture, in which he establishes different ways in which the church, or he calls it Christ, or the experience of Christ, is related to the social reality, or the cultural and social reality. But I would like to, as I said, to look at the dynamic aspect of the church, and the church as something that is emerging. And how is it emerging? The Brazilian Roman Catholic theologian Bernardo Boff has coined a term that is quite awkward, but but in which he tries to convey this this discipline, so to say, examining, perusing over whatever is happening in a given context in which the church is emerging, in which there is what he calls ecclesiogenesis. Means ecclesiogenesis. That means that event through which the church starts to emerge. So it's not taking two entities and putting them in a paritary relationship or in a relationship of correspondence and say, well, this class here requires this kind of religious ideology, this class here requires this kind of religious ideology, and so on and so forth. But looking at examples of what is taking place, when there is a moment in which forces in the midst of our cultural and social world bring about ecclesial formations, bring about spiritual communities into existence. And this is at the very elemental level. We are not talking about religions at this point or denominations, but just as this emergence of a given experience of community that has transcendent dimensions attached to it. Let me, before I move into that, I want to give you an example so that you know what I'm referring to. 1960, Northeast Brazil. Very poor area, very dry, a wilderness. There was a very strong movement of peasants that were working most in sugarcane plantations. And they were, most of them, illiterate. And some of quite exponent intellectuals in the Brazilian society, the best well-known died not very long ago, and I think some of you might have heard of him. His name is Paulo Freire. He was the most famous among them. They went there in order to help, to accompany those people and to provide for some education and improvement. And he developed his famous method of adult literacy that has been used all over the world. But this is another story. What I want to say is that this movement of these peasants that were totally marginal in society, extremely, extremely, extremely poor, and also incapable of articulating their struggle, they start to get really smart. They start to organize themselves. They start to be able to read for themselves, which they were not able to do before. And they formed what was called the peasant leagues. The peasant leagues. And these peasant leagues were very influential in the Northeast political scenario when it happened. When the coup in Brazil happened, 1964, the 31st of March, when the coup happened, the first thing that was decreed is the extinction of all the peasant leagues. And the first act that was done, it was not only a curfew, but the prohibition of any meeting, any time of the day, of more than three persons in any place whatsoever, except the churches. So the churches were still able to go on. And the reason for that is that the church was so inoffensive, so tame, so conservative, that they did not need to be at all concerned about the church. They were concerned about the political character of the peasant leagues. So any meeting except for worship and whatever church meeting that they would be having was totally forbidden. What happened then is that some of this, there was, the, how it developed was very spontaneous. Sometimes it was imitation of mutual parts, but sometimes on one part. The peasants started to flock into the church buildings in order to have their meeting. And there were political meetings. But they were done under the sanctuary of the church. Most of them, almost all of them at that time, Roman Catholic churches, the Protestant renewal had not yet taken place. So they would start to get down there. And those were base communities that were gathering in the church environment in order to discuss political issues. Well, it so happened that the environment in which they were was a religious environment. And it so happened that the host for that meeting were the priests, the nuns, and whoever was church worker at that time. And they would have their pick at what was going on there and eventually would be invited to participate as well. And suddenly there is this metabolic relationship between what is taking place in the political gathering of those peasant leagues and the language that the nuns and the priests would bring to that meeting. And suddenly there was this fruitful encounter, which I call this metabolism, that takes place in this context, in which the peasants themselves say, gosh, we never heard that before. We can call it the pharaoh, and it's much better than the general in order to convey really what is going on with us. Oh, we can call it the Exodus, which is really much better than to just say we are going to have a revolution here. Right? And so there were a number of biblical motifs that suddenly start to invade the secular space in which those peasants were used to organize themselves. And there was this very creative way of reframing what their political struggle is in the context of a biblical language. And when that happens, what happens is this, which Boff called the ecclesiogenesis. The church, the communities, start to become much more than this restrictive group of people with a given political agenda, normally normed by one or another party. And it becomes broader, and it has a spiritual dimension. It doesn't speak anymore about what's going to happen in 10 years or in 5 years. It speaks about what is God's plan in eternal terms, forever, in the midst of our reality. So this is the moment in which what starts to take place in this ecclesiogenesis is the base Christian communities, the emergence of the base Christian communities. No one imagined or no one devised base Christian communities. They were born out of this encounter between the biblical language and this need of a people that were kept at the margin of society. Incidentally, I have a very good friend of mine, Flavio Cuzzi is his name, and he was in exile in Buenos Aires in Argentina because of the coup in Brazil, and then in 65, coup in Brazil happened in 64, and then a coup in Argentina happened in 65, so he was then in exile and ends up there in jail as a political prisoner in Argentina, and he wrote a book of his experience in the Argentinian prison, and the book is called Pieces of Death in My Heart. And he tells about this story. And he was, he's actually he's a Jew, but a secular Jew. And so he is not a religious person at all. But he tells this story beautiful in the book, and he has told me that personally as well. And they were there, and they were prohibited to have any information from the outside world. They could have the Bible. They could have the Bible to read, but they couldn't have, and some books that were totally unrelated to the political situation. But they had the right, newspaper, no way, and they were observed not to speak anything political among themselves, because this was a war that was totally of political prisoners there. And then, well, what they had to do was really to read the Bible, and that's what they were doing. And then suddenly, he tells this story that it was the most magnificent thing that happened, is that suddenly the Bible became itself a sort of a code language for them to speak about realities that were very much or had very much to do with the very current situation in which they were living. So pieces of information that they had, they conveyed in biblical language, yeah, through biblical verses. So it was a code language through which that was happening. It was a similar kind of thing that was taking place. So in which this metabolism between different entities creates a third entity that really represents this emerging spiritual community that I want to talk about. And in this context, I'd like to tell you the story, briefly, the story of a French Arabic scholar, very famous. He was a professor at the École de France in the middle of this century. He was born in 1883 and died in 1962. His name was Louis Massillon. And Louis Massillon was converted to his parents' religion. He was born a Roman Catholic, but never cared much about this. But while in Baghdad, in the midst of his Muslim friends, he converted to Catholicism and adopted Catholicism with a profound respect for the Arab world that he was experiencing at that time. And he developed a spiritual community how to spell this. Which is an Arab word that means substitution. Badaliyah. Substitution. And his idea was something quite revolutionary, but as simple as anything one could think about. And he says, well, the point is not so much hospitality, but the point is really to learn how to be hospitable to the other. And he established as a rule for the community, for the Badaliyah, as a rule for the community, that any one member of that community should first be a guest in a foreign community, in a very strange world, and be simply a guest, and learn how the others would accept him, as different as he was. And just by being accepted, without making requirements, or even with making requirements, he would learn also how to be an host, how to be able to accept the other in his or her own terms, in his or her own life, and in his or her own culture. So he said, well, this question about hosting someone, the question about hospitality, is too naively perceived when it's seen simply as a gesture of a goodwill toward the other, if we don't learn to be guests ourselves in a culture that's different. And I think anyone who has experience of being in a very different culture knows that this can be very scary to tread into territory that is that is unmapped for us. And many times a language that's not known. And even if the language is known, it is not known because the context in which it's spoken really betrays a reality that's totally different, customs that are different, and things that can shock us because we do not expect them to be exactly that way, and they are not civilized as we think they should be as we are, right? So he developed this notion that it was a mutual substitution that should be taken place in the experience of being hospitable to the other and being a guest in somebody else's community. So that is what I meant by the notion of adjacency, right? Being by the side of someone else. Being by the side of someone else. This notion of adjacency is I think what makes for this understanding of what I was trying to describe as this encounter of different entities that allows for the formation of a spiritual reality, of a spiritual community that is something else than whatever has made up for it to come into being, to have this ecclesiogenesis, to have this formation of the spiritual community. Adjacency, the word at ease, or the two words at ease is really etymologically this, jacen, yacere, laying down by someone else. This is what at ease means. Being at ease means that you are able to be by someone else. This is a Brazilian writer and novelist, one of the most well-known from this century, in which he has a beautiful definition of friendship. And he says, friends are those who can be side by side without being armed. Right? And meaning that in metaphorical terms, right? Without being armed, without being defensive, without trying to protect your turf. And so friends are those who can be at ease. That means laying by someone, at the side of someone, without being armed, without being defensive, without being aggressive or whatever else. So this is what I think is crucial for our understanding of where does the community really start, and this is the reason why whatever is the church, whatever marks this beginning or this emergence of the church, comes out of this space of encounter between different entities, between two others that suddenly are at ease, adjacent to one another. And in this adjacency, this metabolic process, which is characterized by whatever chemically happens when two membranes of cells are in contact with each other, and there is a transmission of substance from one to another, right? So that a third reality comes into being. So this metabolism, this is produced by this adjacency, is the condition by which this new entity can come into being, this spiritual community can come into being. We try to avoid this as much as possible, and that's the reason we create institutions. Even the church is an institution to avoid adjacency, so that we can protect ourselves behind it. In the 5th century, tell me this story, I think it's fantastic. In the 5th century, the greatest preacher at that time was a man by the name Chrysostom. And Chrysostom, the name itself says what he was. Chrysostom means the mouth of gold. So he was so famous as a preacher that he was nicknamed the golden mouth. And Chrysostom, in one of his sermons, he really launches, one minute, this attack on the church, on the Constantinian church, that suddenly has all this money of the world in order to really, really carry on its mission, right? And so one of the things that emerges at that time that did not exist before was what was called xenolochia. Xenolochia were houses to host the foreigners, which means the poor, means the marginal, means the sick. So were hospices, hospitals, whatever you call it, but there were houses to host those who were marginal in society and to help them out. Well, Chrysostom launches a first attack on the emergence of this xenolochia. And one would say, gosh, what a conservative man is that, that he doesn't think that the church ought to be serving society. The reason for him doing that was precisely the opposite of what you are thinking. The reason for him attacking this emergence of Xenodokeia, these great institutions that were there to help the poor, the marginalized, the foreigners, the reason for that is that through this institution, said Chrysostom, you are hiding yourself from the face of the other, from the face of the poor. So what he was saying is that whatever we do with many of the institutions, for all the good that they do, be attentive to the fact that they are also designed to prevent you from really meeting the other and being disturbed by the presence of this other that wants to be at ease with you, but you're not going to be very much at ease with him or with her because of the fact that he or she is so much an other that really makes us feel uncomfortable, right?
Peter?
Yes.
Isn't this kind of going full circle back to the Grand Inquisitor from the first day?
Tell me. What's going on in your mind? Yeah.
Well, in the sense that the Grand Inquisitor spots Christ and says did not give what they wanted.
Yeah, and the Grand Inquisitor, there is this distinction between you and him, and the Great Inquisitor makes a distinction. We follow him. That means the institutionalized Jesus Christ, but not you, right? Not you, the present Christ, whose face he was in front of. Thank you.
But this is kind of one of the key parts of that, then, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to say more about that tomorrow before I get to it. Because as usually I'm running behind.
Who are you looking at to get all the mess in your own time? Are you masculine or
No, I was really. I first got to know him. Let me see. And then I saw him in the room.
She said, "Oh, we have to get out of
here." Then I went to some of the texts. He knows quite well. And so he knows Massillon very well. And so he has been
It's just very interesting because some of the stuff
of
Abraham, for the visitors come to Abraham.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing so that I use that I've used is like evangelism notions or everything. Is simply Jesus' instructions in sending out of that which John's purpose meant, like sending out of the 12 or the 70. I mean, basically, as he sends people out, he sends them out not to their hosts, but to their guests. And then, of course, Jesus, if Jesus himself is always that's good to know that.
You can't pick it up, because I like this kiss, and it's going to be one of the
questions. Are you just one of the first one?
The first one wants to cut it.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm total agreement. I think it's the key.
Because there's that
technology. And that the whole, I've done this before.
Well, I will see you then.
The whole sense the church has of evangelism.
Outside.
The understanding is not how do we bring people in, but how do we
That'll be Sunday night.
Yes. Good guests.
Then you can take all my
I was really interested in particularly the last half of your
stuff.
Thank you. I've been thinking along those lines.
Are you sick?
If you are the first, I
will be the last. Okay. If you much help, you did not know that.
In some of his shorter stuff, in some of his Talmudic studies, I'm reading one right now. Where he's doing one of his studies on the cities of refuge. And what is the cities of refuge all about? What requires, of course, your welcoming of the virtues and everything else. You make people who may or may not be innocent and live it to the meaning to give sanctuary. I find those things more helpful. Yeah, I mean,
it was just perfect.
Usually people don't go right away. And that's not helpful. Otherwise, the being is helpful. Some of those. But again, I find his Talmudic studies and some of his shorter essays and whatnot. There's a collection now out. Is it righteous to be? Some of the interviews in there are helpful.
Yeah.
And there's another one. Would it be in English? Entre nous, between us. I don't know what the maybe they keep their but again, there is also that, of course, the encounter with the other, the face, leads to ethics, but he always wants to push that now to something smaller, leads to senses of community, about. So I find some of those other articles and interviews and things like that more helpful in thinking through these things than kind of the classic text for which he's
which is
focusing on what might be your own
theory of free woman.
Interesting stuff.
But she's
It's fun. Good. So it's your meeting over or not yet?
We have one more shot tomorrow morning.
I heard that the meeting was extended, right?
Yeah.
We're supposed to finish today.
We're supposed to finish today.
I'm exhausted.
Huh?
I'm tired.
Did you fall asleep?
Oh.
Good for you.
I almost did.
I didn't think I would because I've been over reading and I was doing okay reading.
I was tuning out there.
This is a hard time, I think, to have it.
Oh, it's a terrible time. I hate this
fall asleep during this time a lot.
But I really like him.
Isn't he good boy, girl?
Oh man, very smart.
So much knowledge and information is just blows me away. So was your drawing
person good?
Basically, it's the line where light and dark meet, you know, and there's a lot of shadow school.
More definition.
Yeah, it's a high contrast, basically.
Yeah.
But it's like shadow is clear and school is obscure.
Oh.
Or like opaque.
Being obscure is
it's like the beer you had the other day.
Really?
It was kind of said that it was a wheat, the color of wheat, or it wasn't filtered. Not like a filter, but there's a different taste. It's clearer. Is dinner next?
Yep, it's a coming.
Do you have any more meetings?
No, tomorrow.
I don't know if it'll work.
Yep.
You know this beat pianist playing tonight? John Bibb knows him.
Really?
Yeah, he's very good stuff. Not personally, but.
Who is it?
So Wyndham Hill artist.
Oh.
They said they had. I think they had some of those recordings over there.
Or they listed his recordings. They could be out now.